tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. AfterBuzz TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
What a somber opening.
That's so good.
Hello, After Buzzers and the internet at large. Welcome to the first after show for season two of FX's Fargo. Now, just right up top, you can follow the network on all social media platforms, iTunes, YouTube, everywhere else where you do your internets at AfterBuzz TV. I am Lex Michael. I'm on all of the inter things. My handle is at the Lex Michael, and with me is
Dave Child. I'm also on internet things at MR Dave Child. So you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, all the jams.
All the jams.
I kick the jams.
That's good. That's encouraging. So we are playing catch up a little bit because we're now a few weeks into season two of Fargo. So we figured the best way for us to catch up, to make the best use of our time, is to cover two episodes at once. So for this show, we are covering episode one, Waiting for Dutch, and episode two, Before the Law. But before we get too far into the specific content of the episodes, I wanted to ask you, Dave, what is your relationship with Fargo as a property? Like everybody, you know, you come to the movie first, and that's where the series is based. What was your relationship with the movie? How did you discover it, if you remember? And what was your reaction when you read that they were turning it into an episodic series, A, and B, when you finally saw it? How did you feel about it?
Well, for one, I'm surprised that Fargo is a property now.
It is a property. Weird.
It feels like such a quiet movie that's like a cult favorite at the time, and I loved it. I watched it, I think, when I was in high school and fell in love with it right away. It wasn't actually even my like favorite Coen Brothers movie at the time, but I feel like it's you get the best of both worlds with the Coen Brothers. You get like the death, you get the murder, you get, but you get this weird dark humor that they always have. And I just fell in love with it there. And then when I found out they were making a show out of it, I did not want to watch it. I wanted to stay as far away from it as possible. I was like, they have to come up with original TV. I don't know why they're just taking a fantastic movie and they're going to destroy it. I thought it was going to be about the characters from Fargo. Sure. I thought it was going to be just this totally just ruining the movie in general. And then I saw it and realized it's one of the best TV shows on TV.
Yep.
And that they did an amazing job of adapting the feeling and the themes and the mood of a movie without actually touching upon the plot of the movie, except like a brief thread.
In it, there is one particular plot point, and it has to do with a large amount of cash that ties it directly into the movie and does, in a way, if you look at the timeline, I suppose make it a sequel to the movie in some sense.
It does. It does make it a, like, but it also, it comes out like something that happens in a Coen Brothers movie or something that happens in that type of movie where it seems like it's manna from heaven, and that made it perfect. Yes. There was no character threads. I thought we were going to get a it did follow like a female lead, but she wasn't even like the sheriff at the beginning of the series. So it was different. It was she was a deputy at that time.
Yes.
And I felt like, and she was able to escalate and become a whole different character than one of like the best female characters of movies.
Absolutely.
So that was great.
Yeah.
How did you discover it?
So I, like you, I think I must have been high school when I was really digging into movies for the first time, when I was blossoming as a little film nerd.
Blossoming.
And it's one of those, maybe you can relate to this. It's a lot like that feeling, I was thinking about this earlier, like when you see Pulp Fiction for the first time.
Yeah.
And you realize, even if you're 14 when you see it, and you don't yet have the vocabulary to explain to somebody why this is opening your mind up so much, you just know it is. You know without being able to quite explain it to anybody else that you're watching something truly, truly special. And if you are, like I was, a blossoming film nerd.
So it, little disgusting, but I like it. Blossoming.
It's just the proper amount of color. But it is something transformative about certain movies at certain times in your life. And even though I can't tell you, I saw Fargo for the first time in 19 blah, 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 whatever. I remember the experience of watching it and going, okay, there's everything in my brain as far as its relationship to movies pre-Fargo, and then there's everything post-Fargo. And it was – I mean, look, I could say that about half the Coen Brothers movies that I've seen. Well,
the great thing about the movie and also the show is it breaks – It breaks boundaries as far as genre. Like, you can't quite say what genre this show is.
Right.
Never mind also the movie. You can't tell if it is a thriller, it is a noir, but it's also a comedy, it's a dark comedy, it's a drama, it actually has some horror elements to it. And it's all over the map, and that's why I think it identifies. And like, this is something different, so this is mine now. I'm gonna take it.
Absolutely.
This is mine, cause it sees the world like I see it, it is not in black and white, not in like comedy versus drama.
So. Absolutely, absolutely. So, I agree with you that I think season one of this show did a fantastic job of replicating the elements that to me made Fargo as a movie feel very unique and very fresh and very eye-opening without rehashing the same points over and over. It felt very fresh and it felt very alive and new and rich and full. And the writing was spectacular. The cast was absolutely top-notch.
Yeah.
And it does, obviously, even though the series is designed as an anthology series, each season is its own contained story.
Which is great.
It keeps you from being stuck in a trap of having to devise arcs for people over many, many years, regardless of whether or not the material is there to sustain the story.
Yeah, I mean, the showrunner, Noah Hawley, has talked about how the point of Fargo and why Fargo was such a good movie and what he wanted to capture in the show is that you feel like after the events that happen in the show, the next day is going to be just another day.
Yes.
It's just going to be another day and everything's going to go back to normal. And you can't really do that if it's the same people, if it's the same cast.
Right.
Always having these Coen Brothers type crazy plot lines, you feel like, okay, Fargo is just, that's a crazy place.
Why does anyone live there?
Yeah, that's no. I mean, you still feel that with the show.
But slightly.
But you're like, you feel like they want to go back to a normal that does exist.
Yes. So. And that's exactly how the movie ended as well.
Right.
Frances McDormand's character goes through this harrowing ordeal, but at the end of the movie, she's in bed with her husband, and you get the feeling that the next day, she'll go to work, just like any other day.
It's just every other day.
Yeah. And so, season one, I think we both agree, was an exceptional piece of television.
And season two, because there's a lot of anthology series now, or like, I guess three. There's American Horror Story and there's True Detective.
Yes.
And after the second season of True Detective, it made everyone go, ooh, maybe anthology series aren't good. Maybe.
For those listening that are going, season two of True Detective was, let's say, divisive at best.
I haven't seen it, but I heard it's a train wreck, and that's why I haven't seen it.
Well, I try to keep it positive, so we're going to go with divisive at best.
A positive train wreck. But it's not the show we're talking about today.
Right.
So but it made a lot of critics didn't like it. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
So it made people wonder if the next Fargo series will have the same problem, because it's kind of like the sophomore disease, where you come out with one great album, so maybe the next album isn't so great.
Sure.
So they were worried about that. But this series is amazing.
Yes.
It's
we're like I said, we're playing catch up for our after show. I've only seen up till now the two episodes that we're going to cover.
Same here.
They're both fantastic.
Great.
And the only other note that I want to make before we dive into the episodes themselves are connective tissue to the first season of this show. Because the first season, correct me if I'm wrong, was more or less set present day.
Yeah, it was set in 2006.
So a couple years ago, but more or less present day. This season is set in 1979. And one of the central characters, Lou Salverson, played by Patrick Wilson, is present in season one. That character is played by Keith Carradine, and he's the father of Molly Salverson, who's our protagonist in that season.
He owns the diner. Yeah, and then always is interacting that way.
And he alludes to having seen some things in his day, and you get the feeling, and it's, you know, it helps to have an actor like Keith Carradine to convey these things, but he's been through it as an officer of the law. And so you have that going on in the back of your head every time you see Keith Carradine in season one. What are those things?
Yeah, what things did he see? And now we get to see those things.
We do. So, 1979. And you, right before we jumped on mic, you reminded me of the way the first episode of the season opens. And I agree, we have to touch on it. So I wanted to let you...
Yeah, first we hear the classic Fargo theme that we started off the show with, that kind of low, I don't know the name of that piece, but the like, but we hear it as scratchy, and it's not in widescreen, it's just in standard, and we see it's like a old West movie. And and we come in on a Native American, or a guy playing a Native American, in front of a field of dead people, wondering what his line is. And they're all waiting for Reagan to get on screen. And it takes place in Fargo, because apparently that's where the actual massacre of Sioux Falls happened, around there?
Sioux Falls is South Dakota, I believe.
South Dakota.
Yes.
Okay. Or there's some sort of wars or massacre that happened around where this movie is taking place, this 10-hour movie is taking place. And then it just kind of, then it cuts right to 1979. And it's strange, and I'm really wondering how it ties back. And it makes me feel like Reagan is actually going to be a big part of the show. But I don't know when or how it's going
to
get to him.
We're going to come back to that in predictions at the end of the show, because I do want to comment on that a little bit, because I agree with you. It definitely seems to be they're dropping enough Ronald Reagan centric hints already in the first two episodes that this has to pay off somehow. Or why is it there?
Yeah.
So I figure, since we're covering two episodes, the easiest way, and we talked about this before we came on mic, maybe the easiest way to get through everything that we have to get through is by focusing on groups of characters and their journey over these first two episodes. So I wanted to start with, of these groupings, the largest assemblage of characters, the Gerhardt family.
Yes.
And the Gerhardt family, as presented to us in the first episode, is the most prominent organized crime syndicate that operates out of the titular town of Fargo.
Yeah.
Their hold on their territory is threatened by two events that happen in pretty quick succession.
Yeah.
The first is that the patriarch of the family, Otto Gerhardt, suffers a debilitating stroke.
Right. But before that, actually, they're having money trouble.
Yes.
They talk about how the business isn't bringing enough money in. And one of the youngest, Rye, is not, especially not pulling his weight, which is important in the Fargo universe. It's weird that there's a Fargo-verse. Fargo universe.
Yeah.
Fargoverse. In the Fargoverse. Yeah. Because there's always a sense of, there's always someone who is not making money. It's usually a male character who's not like living up to that kind of male stereotype of needing to bring in the bread and is resorting to very desperate needs. So, one of the things that Rye does is he tries to join a business about an electric typewriter.
That's right, yes.
Yeah, it's an electric typewriter, but the only thing that's holding back on it is a judge who's holding the money of the guy who invented the typewriter and is trying to sell the typewriter.
Right.
So his mission was to talk to the judge. But he's not a very bright guy. This guy's played by Culkin.
Kieran Culkin.
And to me, I actually thought when I first met him, like, is he playing young Steve Buscemi? Is this how it's going to tie into the movie? Is he like a very young Steve Buscemi and this is his kind of story?
Sure.
As he gets older, and then...
It's not.
It's not.
At all.
It's definitely not. Because we find, should we get into the Waffle House?
So so two things happen basically simultaneously.
Okay.
One is the stroke of the family patriarch, who, by the way, played by Michael Hogan. If anyone listening is a fan of Battlestar Galactica, you will recognize him immediately as Saul Tye. Mm-hmm. I'm always happy to see that dude.
It's always good to see Saul.
Well, it's good because I just, every time, no matter what he's doing, I hear him yelling about Cylons and stuff.
Yeah, no matter how many eyes he has, it's great to see him.
He thinks everyone's a robot and he's real mad about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, We see this happen, and then we see what Rye takes it upon himself to do, or rather attempt to do, and he goes to this Waffle House, and he initially seems like he's going to try and talk to the judge.
To the judge. who does not want to listen, sprays him in the face with bug spray, and there's a massacre that happens.
Essentially.
Yeah. If you're listening to this, if you're watching this, you've seen the show. And so you'll know that he brought out a gun and basically just started shooting everybody at the Waffle House.
Yes.
And getting stabbed himself. So he wanders out into trying to make it look like a robbery. He had the foresight to make it look like a robbery because he grabs all the money in the cash register.
Yes.
And then leaves the Waffle House. But as he leaves the Waffle House, he sees a UFO.
Yes. And a flying spacecraft.
Yeah, a flying spacecraft. And then gets hit by a car that does not stop. And then just keeps driving.
We do find out a little bit later in the episode who's driving the car, but on the first appearance of this vehicle, of Rye getting hit by this vehicle, it's almost the car stops just long enough that you know the driver's reacting and thinking about what to do. The car just takes off and drives away.
Right.
So these two things, taken in conjunction with one another, put the Gerhardts in a very tenuous position.
Yeah.
Which is very bad timing, because especially now in light of the Patriarch's stroke, the members of a Kansas City-based syndicate are now planning to move in and take over that territory.
A little hostile takeover.
Yeah, and one of them is Brad Garrett.
Yeah.
One of them is Brad Garrett. His character's name is Joe Bulo, and he arrives...
That's the older brother from Everybody Loves Raymond, right?
Yes.
Who you're talking about?
Yes, okay. Yes.
That's how I know people.
Yeah, and he arrives on the scene with a character named Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers.
The Kitchen Brothers.
Who are two mute... they look like Hasidic Jews, and there's two of them.
Which, by the way, is kind of weird, because as NPR... characters that do their own podcast called the Kitchen Sisters. So it's weird to see the opposite of them is like these very sweet sisters that run a NPR show. The very opposite of them are mute killers, or we assume are killers, or
see,
mafia
that,
people.
Then I genuinely hope that's an intentional nod to NPR.
Yeah, I bet it is.
I genuinely hope
it is. Fargo, the show. I bet it's an NPR nod of some sort. Anyways.
So knowing now that these hoods from Kansas City are making a bid to take over their share of business in Fargo, the matriarch of the family, Floyd, is trying to tell her sons, and nobody can find Rye, of course, because unbeknownst to them, Rye is off dead somewhere.
Yeah.
But she's trying to, especially her oldest son, Dodd, trying to say, you know, let me get us through this difficult time. I know you're the eldest male. Yes, your father's out of commission. It is your throne to have. Your legacy will be there. She knows that Dodd's not the guy to get them through this patch.
Right.
So she beseeches him, please let me get us through this. And once we get to the other side of it, I will step aside. I will, I believe she, I'm paraphrasing, but she essentially says, you know, I'll start planning for the grave, essentially.
Yeah. I'll turn my ideas to the grave.
Yes. That's exactly what she says.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so what ends up happening there is, the older brother is Dodd, right?
Dodd is the eldest.
Yeah. Dodd is the eldest. He still wants power. So what everyone needs is they need the last brother on their side. They need Rye to be on their side. So then there's a search by the Kansas City Mafia to look for at least one of the family members that will turn to them. And it seems like maybe one of the only family members that will turn to them is Rye.
Right.
So they're looking for Rye. The Kansas City people are looking for Rye. And the older brother's looking for Rye, and the mom is looking for Rye.
Right.
So everyone's looking for Rye at this point. So where is Rye is where we go next, as we meet the Blomquists.
The Blomquists,
who are Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons.
Yes, the characters' names are Peggy and Ed Blomquist. And we do come to find at the end, or towards the end of the first episode, that it was Peggy who was driving the car who hit Rye. And
by the way, the showrunner, Noah, has said that his idea for season two started with the single image of a housewife with a dead person in her windshield.
Yeah.
That's like, he was like, I like this image. Let's see what story I can make out of that. And that's where it started. So it makes sense it's in the pilot.
And you see, as she drives home with this dead person in her windshield, you see her arrive at home, not still clearly processing it and not having the wherewithal to really be able to process what just happened. She gets out of the car. She goes inside. She sits down. She cleans herself up. She's not going to tell tell her husband about it at first.
Doesn't say a single thing.
No, when Ed comes home, he has to figure out for himself that something's not quite right here.
Right. And these characters are very important in the Fargoverse because they kind of – there's always a sense of, like, people that want – to Fargo is essentially, this is what the showrunner said, so I can't take credit for this, evil, not evil versus good, but evil versus decency.
Yes.
So it's just a sense of like trying to, everyone in the Midwest is just trying to be decent. They're trying to be decent people, very polite, very nice, and try not to make a ruckus. So these characters are, you have the male character who is out to, what's his name? The Ed. You have Ed's character who just wants to own a butcher shop.
He just wants to take over the family business.
Yeah, he wants to have kids like it's the 60s again.
Yes.
And he just wants to, like, you know, live a happy, quiet life. And then you have Peggy who is going through the – this takes place in 1979, which is very important. So it's just after a sense of, like, a giant feminist movement and a feeling that, okay, I have to find my own. I have to be a part of my own. So she is struggling to find her place in the world, and she's trying to figure out how to go in that direction. And when this happens, I think she just tries to, like, block it out and just tries to make it so, like, I got to be decent. I can't say anything. None of anything that happens here would happen if she just went straight to the police and just said, I got into an accident. They'll be like, oh, you hit this murderer. It's totally fine.
You did us a favor. Thank you.
Yeah, but because she doesn't want to make a ruckus, she drives home.
Everything that she does in these first two episodes, and you know, now that presumably people listening have seen these first two episodes, she convinces Ed to help her cover the entire thing up for the sake of keeping up appearances and not making a fuss.
Yeah, and it brings Ed into – now Ed is not like – he's not someone who has to deal with his wife who accidentally killed someone. He is someone who is a murderer himself. Oh, because we should add that Rye wasn't quite dead when he came home.
He was most of the way dead.
He was most of the way dead, but he wasn't quite dead. So you heard some – he heard some thudding. He went in. Rye attacked him. He killed him in self-defense.
To be fair –
If he went to the police there, there's a strong likelihood he would be able to go away scot-free.
It's still the murderer they were looking for.
Yeah. He's still a murderer. They still killed a murderer.
Right.
But he had to cover it up. So you see him cleaning up the garage, and you see him have to dispose of the body.
Yes.
Which happens in the second episode, but we're covering both here.
Yeah.
So he brings the body to his butcher shop. And starts carving up that body.
Which is very reminiscent. We mentioned when we were talking before the show, very reminiscent of spoilers for Fargo, the movie, which is the better part of 20 years old now. If you haven't seen it, shame on you.
Well, also, why are you watching this show if you haven't seen
that movie? The movie's so much shorter. You could you could watch it 2 hours and go, this show probably isn't for me if you don't like the movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, Steve Buscemi's character meets a grisly end and is put into a wood chipper by Peter Stormare. And to me, I mean, of course, they're making a Fargo series. Naturally, they know every frame of the source material. I can't imagine that was not an intentional nod to that moment
in
the movie.
Now, was it his foot when he went into the grinder? It must have been his foot.
It's Steve Buscemi's foot
in the movie. In the wood chipper.
There was definitely – I think there might have been a hand. There was some appendage that you can see Ed have to put into –
which, by the way, I think is a much cleaner way of getting rid of a body than a wood chipper.
Oh, yeah.
I think that wood chipper was a bad move because you show up and it's still there's still blood on the snow.
Oh, all over the snow.
All over the snow. But okay. So now let's go back to the Waffle House after what happened at the Waffle House.
Yes.
Because we have to look at the people investigating.
Yes, I made a whole ordeal of touching on the Lou Salverson character. So we have to come back to Lou Salverson, who is, I would say, the closest thing to a moral center we have in this show.
Yeah.
Him and Hank, the Ted Danson character, the sheriff.
Yeah. Well, the cops in Fargoverse tend to be either the moral centers or complete
inept
and completely inept. And in this time we meet two cops, and they both seem to be pretty centered.
Yes.
So, yeah, the Ted Danson character and Lou, which makes me worry, by the way, it's a side note, for the Ted Danson character.
Oh, that was the first episode when I saw Ted Danson. I'm like, this guy's really great. He's going to die, isn't he?
Yeah, he's so going to die. He's not dead yet in the first two episodes, but I'm really worried for his well-being because he's just too much of a nice guy, and I feel like
So there. Okay. So and there's a moment in the second episode to your point that we can touch on in a minute. But first, right. I do want to talk about Lou and his family a little bit, yeah. because like we mentioned, he is the Keith Carradine character in season one, the father of Molly, the protagonist, and you see Lou, the Patrick Wilson version of Lou in 79, at home with his daughter. You see young yeah. Molly, and you see Lou's wife, who has cancer, who's recently started undergoing chemotherapy. And, mm-hmm. you know, unfortunately, you know, if you've seen season one, Molly's mother is not around. Is
not around, whatever that means. So.
Sure. And look, in the Fargoverse, as we have yeah. taken to calling it, it could be any number of things. Now they've introduced the possibility of aliens, so maybe she's in space somewhere.
Oh, my God.
But we meet her, and we see this tender, loving relationship between Lou and his wife, and how he takes care of her, and how there is this fantastic give and take.
Yeah, there's a sense of respect, too. That's really nice. And I think that's... You could see that instilled into Molly, I think, especially as they grow older. In all the Fargo shows, it's really nice to see these well-developed female characters.
Absolutely.
Because that doesn't tend to happen in just TV and movies in general.
Agreed.
So it always makes it like, wow, they actually know how to write a woman. And they yeah. actually know how to like have that person be also like a mom, but still three-dimensional and not yes. just like this Mother Mary character or something.
Well, there's a moment in the second episode where they go back to – Lou goes back to the Waffle House, the yeah. scene of the crime.
Because he's got a hunch that he hasn't seen everything at the Waffle House.
And his wife and daughter are with him. And while he goes inside and he's poking around, the wife – Betsy is the character's name. Betsy and young Molly are outside, and Betsy finds Rye's gun.
Right.
She's actually – and it's funny. Lou makes the comment, oh, mommy's doing daddy's job again.
Yeah.
And this excites Molly to no end. And it's great having yeah. seen season one. And you see this amazing – not just amazing woman but amazing police officer that Molly Salverson eventually grows into. And you go, well, A, okay, you've got your dad and your dad is who he is. But you look at the way they're portraying her mother and you see like, well, no wonder Molly is who Molly is in season one. Being that is her mom.
Yeah, yeah. It's great to see. And then so what happens with that? I think we're touching upon everything that happens in the two episodes. Because the important thing to remember about the show is it's mostly about ambiance and what the show and the character development,
yes.
rather than it is about actual things happening.
Well, and there are so many wonderful little moments. And now that we've touched on the groups of characters and most of the big plot elements of the first couple episodes, I did want to touch on some of the smaller moments that I really, really love.
Right. Well, we do have to mention when Lou ends up at the butcher shop.
Yes, this is important.
In the second episode, right when Ed is, you know, doing his grinding away before Grinder. he was grinding away, and Lou shows up because he sees that the light's on and he just wants to pick up some bacon.
Yeah, pick up some bacon.
For his family. And in the, what's great is in the Fargo verse, we know we've had so much experience of people just being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yep.
And just happening to like find something that's just seeing something. So he goes in to pick up bacon, and it becomes a game of trying to hide evidence that there's a human body being grinded in the back, including fingers that end up going under the door and hiding them. So it's a great tense moment. I just wanted to touch upon
it before. I'm glad that you did, because it's interesting, too. You see, much like in season one, there's a character in this case, it's Ed, who suddenly finds himself he's never killed somebody before, let right. alone had to dispose of a body and lie to a police officer about it. He's immediately, instantly in way over his head. And it's interesting to see, you saw the same thing happen with Martin Freeman's character in season one.
Yeah.
But the big difference is, I think, in the moral core of those two people. Whereas Martin Freeman in season one pretty quickly gave in to some of his darker impulses.
Right. Well, he wanted to be a man. He wanted to be like the most manly man he could possibly be, because he was cowed by his by his wife.
And so, it's the marriage dynamic, I think. I think you hit the nail exactly on the head. Martin Freeman was so belittled and verbally, emotionally abused by his wife that it became exactly the way you just put it. It became, I need to prove that I'm a man and I need to do all of this. And it took him to a very dark place. Jesse Plemons' character, Ed, he and his wife have, for all intents and purposes, what seems like a very strong, good, loving relationship.
Yeah.
And
he just, his sense of being a man is also like, own a butcher shop.
Yeah.
Have lots of kids. And that's really what he wants.
It's the difference between I'm going to be a man and I'm going to be a family man.
Right.
You know?
Right. I also want to touch upon, before we run out of time, I want to touch upon, like, Fargo has all these little nods towards all these other Coen brother properties and, like, nods.
And there is one thought I want you to expound upon that a little bit, because in talking about some of the smaller moments, there was one specifically that stuck out to me that drew my mind immediately to another Coen brothers property, but I wanted to get your thoughts first.
Just because we were talking about the butcher shop, right across from the butcher shop is a pharmacy. It's in my notes somewhere, but I forget the name of it. But it's the same pharmacy. It's the name of the same pharmacy that in No Country for Old Men, there's a giant, like, explode, like, car bomb in front of. So there's even...
I didn't even catch that.
Yeah, there's even this weird link there. And on top of it, you also get the first episode. I think it's the first episode ends with Go to Sleep Now, Little Baby, that You and Me and the Devil Makes Three. This, like, wonderful Americana song that's from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
That's right.
That the sirens sing to lure them into, like, the lake there, into the river. So it's this nice little, like, oh, whoa, that's from another Coen Brothers thing. And then there's Reagan. There's the poster of Reagan. There's a poster of Reagan behind, actually, Nick Offerman's character, who...
Yeah, we haven't even mentioned that Nick Offerman is also on this show, playing a character, by the way, named Carl Weathers, which is quite possibly the greatest decision on the part of the writers and casting directors that I've ever heard.
I didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is... I think he's actually introducing a theme that we're going to see throughout the show, which is a sense of conspiracy.
Sure.
And the idea that... Because everyone's talking about Watergate. It's 1979. Everyone's talking about Watergate, so they've just been introduced to the idea that the government is doing things they might not be comfortable with. A war that they hate just happened. A lot of them are bringing that violence home. There's a sense of that. And so the whole – all the – everything that's happening with the government is different to them. And we see a poster of Reagan behind him as he's talking about all these conspiracies.
And if you look very closely at the poster,
you realize the poster is actually Bruce Campbell as Reagan, which is amazing for one reason. It means I hope in a future episode we see Bruce Campbell as Reagan. I hope we see that. I hope, because they've introduced Reagan in the beginning of the show.
Yep.
They're putting the seed that Reagan is played by Bruce Campbell. But he's uncredited in this, which is amazing, because in the Fargo movie, you actually see Bruce Campbell in the cabin that Peter Stormare is watching.
That's right.
Because he's watching a soap opera that Bruce Campbell was in. Because Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell, Coen Brothers, they were all friends. They all helped out each other.
Right.
So what I'm wondering is actually if the UFO... To go back to the conspiracy...
Wait, do you want to hold on to this for predictions?
Okay,
because... I'm
really looking forward to predictions.
No, okay, I want space Reagan. I want to hear this.
No.
But I wanted to touch on what you just said. A couple of things, specifically thematic ties to other Coen Brothers works, and then you started to talk about we're just post Vietnam now. The boys are coming home from Nam now.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful scene in the second episode between Lou and
Ted Danson's character
and Ted Danson's Harry. Yeah. And they're sitting on a porch and they're talking. And Ted Danson is saying how after World War II, we came home and locally we got through the 50s essentially without murders happening locally. And then
he also said it was like the best. There was no murders for 6 years.
Yep.
So it felt like you got the sense that it actually helped everyone back home.
Yes.
To come back. It kind of cleansed the evil out of people.
Absolutely. And then he comments on, and it's important to note that Lou, the Patrick Wilson character, just himself recently came back from Vietnam. And Ted Danson says to him, you know, you guys come back from this war and now we're starting to see more of these people committing violent crimes against each other again. And it's like you boys brought the war home with you.
Right.
And that was fascinating to me for a couple of reasons. But the biggest one and what stuck in my mind, it popped out to me almost immediately, is that what he's describing is he's seeing all this violence and he's not really sure how to respond to it. And it feels like the world, this good, decent world that he conceptualized, or at least is more able to see than the people around him, or many of the people around him, is eroding away from under him. And I immediately flashed to Tommy Lee Jones in No Country for Old Men, who's right. having almost the exact same existential crisis about looking at how the world is changing and seeing all of the ways in which it seems to be changing for the worse. And you can't always explain it. You can't rationalize it. You don't always know what to do about it.
Yeah.
And it's literally, I was almost waiting for Ted Danson to say, you know, this country, it's not for old men anymore. Yeah. I just would have been like, I would have stood up at home and just clapped and been like, yeah, yeah, there it is.
We get it. We get it.
But I'm like, immediately, it's this exact same thematic existential quandary that Tommy Lee Jones had in that movie. And I thought that that was an interesting parallel.
I'm just waiting for someone to say, you know, for kids at some point. It'd be perfect. But that's actually important because a big sense of this show is how evil exists in the heart of man, which sounds like we're talking about The Shadow. But I'm really talking about, because it's all about, and one thing I'm actually really excited about this season is I love the first season, but Billy Bob Thornton's character was so evil.
Just a pure malevolent force.
Yeah, he was that. And it felt odd in the Fargo universe. It felt like everyone had to just like, how are we going to deal with this evil force that's coming in?
Well, and you've had, in the movie, certainly, you had some bad guys.
Yeah, Peter Stormare was kind of that evil force.
And you assume that they answer to other bad guys. Even though Stormare and Buscemi, it seemed like they were more or less working freelance, you know at some point in their criminal careers, they probably kick up to somebody even nastier. But Lorne Malvo, the Billy Bob Thornton character in season one, is, for all intents and purposes, the devil.
Yes, yeah. And so far in this series, it seems like we have people that are all trying to be decent, all trying to be good, and they're dealing with the evil that, just this little bit of evil that exists inside of them.
Yes.
Just these little tweaks and nods that they have to like deal with. And that's a much more interesting like thematic direction to take.
Absolutely.
Than like, oh, I have to deal with this doomsday monster that's hitting me.
Sure. Well, I like what you said, and you attributed it to Noah Hawley, but the idea of it's not good versus evil, it's evil versus decency. Because
right.
so often in our lives, most of us, I mean, did you tell me if your experience differs from mine?
Oh, I'm evil.
We don't,
yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. But we don't, you know, most of our struggles are not this cataclysmic, you know, God and the devil type showdown to end all showdowns to decide the fate of humanity
right.
type deal. It's more often the issues that we as human beings face day in and day out, even evil is a little melodramatic, but it's just about finding the good parts of ourselves and nurturing those so that the bad parts of ourselves don't start to take those over.
Yeah, it's true.
And you see that, and that's my concern, and we're about to get into predictions. But that's my concern for the Jesse Plemons character, is that he seems like such a great guy who's going along with it because that's what he thinks is right, you know, for his wife and their prospects and their family. What happens when these dark things, you start feeding them without even realizing it? What happens when they are fed far more than the little good parts, and you know what happens?
Yeah, and Jesse Plemons is such good casting for that guy because he's played like, you know, he was in Breaking Bad, he was in Friday Night Lights, and he's played everyone in Friday Night Lights. He was like the epitome of good. He was the moral compass in that show. And then in Breaking Bad,
he was a total sociopath.
Oh, he was such a sociopath. And he has that great, he has a face that you can't quite tell what's going on
right.
behind him, but in that very like intriguing way. So his development is going to be really great. It's to see how he either falls. They call, again, Noah has said that the thing with Fargo, it's in the line between tragedy and comedy, because when it's a tragedy, it means it's something that has an inevitable end.
Sure.
It's something that you're watching a slow car wreck. You're watching something happen and you know they can't stop it when there's so many moments where they could have stopped it.
Yep.
And then they didn't.
Yep.
Where it becomes comedy is when that's a little unpredictable and when you can kind of like recognize that kind of sense of, I don't know, that fault sure. as your own without really connecting too much to it. You know, sure. it's like,
absolutely.
It's the difference between falling down the stairs and watching someone fall down the stairs.
Yes.
But it's also, if you slow down that fall down the stairs, that's where it's tragedy, because you're like, if only he didn't take that step,
and that's,
then he would be fine.
And that's what we saw in season one, and yeah. that's what my fear is we're going to see again in season right. two. And on that note, I do want to move into predictions.
Okay. This is the one thing I want to bring up about the UFO.
Yes, tell me about the Space Reagan theory of yours.
Well, it's not Space Reagan. It's like you're jumping on Space Reagan. I think it's a little Space Reagan. I think it might have something to do with Star Wars, but the Reagan Star Wars. So Reagan had a Star Wars program where he was trying to put up like things in space, like satellites, to fight the Russians. I think it's a little bit of that, a little bit of experimental aircraft. I would say it's all just in his head, but the thing is, he dies instantly.
Yes.
So we're never going to know if it's all just in his head, unless they pay it off somewhere down the line. Unless they say something like, oh, he's always had hallucinations. But that would suck. You know, it needs to have like some reasoning in the world that isn't too far out, that isn't too jump the shark. And I think it might have something to do with conspiracies.
Sure.
And the government, because they're entering this theme of like, someone down the road is like, they're pulling strings. People are pulling strings.
Yes.
And everyone's behind it. So I'm thinking that we're going to meet Reagan at some point, because it's the things that are happening in Fargo, I think, are somehow going to be connected to Washington.
Okay.
And I think maybe Kansas City Mafia might also be part of that too, because we don't really know who they are, except they're from Kansas City.
Right.
That's it.
And one of them is Ray Romano's brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you don't really know. They're all of different ethnicities. And they're all like, so they could actually be part of the government, maybe? It's like, you don't really know. So it's all, I think there's some sort of government conspiracy is going to come into this. And maybe the UFO has something to do with that.
Sure.
So what are your predictions?
So, okay, obviously we're seeing these two factions, the Gerhard family, and you know that Dodd is not going to let Floyd run things sensibly. You know he's going to let his ego right. take control, and you know that's going to put them into direct, presumably violent conflict with the Kansas City Syndicate. And you know a bunch of people are going to die very violently. That is to be expected. I'm curious to see how far down this rabbit hole of darkness our couple, Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons couple go in an attempt to appear decent. And that's the other thing. Decency isn't decency if all you're concerned about is the appearance of decency.
Right.
There's that. Where the spaceship is concerned, I would be surprised, honestly, if we saw more. I would say maybe, I think it's possible, some other character on the other side of the light-dark spectrum, maybe someone like a Lou Salverson, towards the end of the season might have a sighting like that. But I don't think they're going to pay it off with anything substantial. I think it's going to end up being more of like a Serious Man, Embrace the Mystery type deal.
Yeah, that might be true. That's probably very true,
now,
actually.
That said, there is a scene in episode 2. And it's a scene where the Ted Danson character is essentially a one-man roadblock. And Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers show up in their car. And he brings them out of the car. He questions them. And he ends up saying, you know, you guys go along, but I'm going to Radiohead to make sure that you guys leave the state. If you don't leave the state, we're going to be talking again.
Right.
Two things that I want to bring up in relation to that scene. A, Mike Milligan is that... So far, of all the characters, he's the closest one that I've seen to being a malevolent force of some kind. He's dark, he's cryptic, and he's basically making these threats that are just veiled enough that they don't play as threats.
Right.
And that was the scene where I went, I think something bad's going to happen to Ted Danson.
Yeah.
But also, if they do decide towards the end of the season to tell us, oh yeah, Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers are totally from space, I'm going to go, oh, well, yeah, all right, that makes enough sense. You saw them. You saw the way the Kitchen Brothers move totally in unison and silently. Terrifying. If you tell me they're extraterrestrials, yeah. I'll go, well, yeah, Fargo. I'll buy that.
Yeah. We'll see.
We will see. But that is going to do it for this first wrap-up of Fargo Season 2, Episodes 1 and 2. Dave, where can people find you on the internet?
At Mr. Dave Child, at the Twitter and the Instagram.
All right, I am on all of the inter-thingies. As I mentioned, my handle is at TheLexMichael. Go check us out on YouTube, subscribe, like us on iTunes, let everybody know how wonderful you think that we are, and we will see you next week to talk about Fargo some more.
Yes.
Thank you for tuning in. See you next time.
Bye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.